Okay, so this is at MJE, and we're taking up the story of Avraham and Avimelech. Now, for background, you know the story of Avraham when he went to Mitzrayim. Okay? When he went traveling, he had a major liability, which was what? His wife. Okay? Could never marry a pretty woman. You know, it's dangerous. Especially in the times of... So when he went down to Egypt, he was concerned that they would take... It was an immoral society. Mm-hmm. And he was concerned that they'd see this beautiful woman and it's a stranger and he'd be the husband. And what would happen?
They'd kill him.
Right. So in order to preserve himself, what did he do?
Yeah,
because they would... That was the psychology. That is, they would want to take her, but they don't want the husband around. Right? So... For whatever reason, even an immoral society likes to pretend. They're not going to openly do a thing like that, take another man's wife and the man's around. I mean, he's going to protest it. They're not going to do something which is openly an expression.
They'd give him a hard time.
They'd give him a hard time. They'd see to it that he had an accident. It's more convenient that way. Right. It's more convenient to get rid of him. That he was concerned about that. So therefore, the only way that he could stay alive and be some type of, as long as he's around, there's something he could possibly do to help her. They agreed to this, that he claimed that she was his sister. In which case, it would be just the opposite. Not only then, in that situation, not only would they not hurt him, but to the contrary, they'd want to be nice to him.
Right.
They'd want to give him gifts and so on and so forth, because so they could marry her. And, you know, it was an immoral society, but like our society, superficially, they sought to observe certain types of... customs or rules and so forth, you know. So that's indeed what happened. But so she was taken to Paro. She was taken to Paro because of her great beauty. And then what happened? Hashem intervened and smote Paro with illnesses, with sicknesses, and he never was with her. And finally, the truth came out. And it's slightly different than the story with Avimelech, because he's ferociously angry and he kicks him out of the country, which is fine because he realized that this was from God, it was a punishment from God, and that he couldn't trust any of his, that's why the commentators said that, that's why he told him to leave the country, because he was afraid somebody else would do this, and then this is a person that's protected by God, and he was afraid that it would bring down punishments on the country. That's the first incident. There's a second incident over here. Now we're taking up chapter 20, which on the surface seems to be a similar incident, although it's different, it's not the same. And because now Avraham is by the land of the Negev. Do you have that, chapter 20, mm-hmm. verse 1? I'm going to go through the verses rather quickly. And he dwelled in Gerar, and the king of Gerar was Avimelech. And again, and Avraham said about Sarah, this time it would appear that he just decided that was his policy, that he told the people that Sarah was his sister, and Avimelech, the king of Gerar, sent for her and took Sarah. So apparently, you know, word got back to him that this is a beautiful woman, so on and so forth. So you have a similar, if not identical, situation. You'll see that there are certain differences. Then it says that God came to Avimelech in a dream of the night, which means to say that God communicated with him in a dream. That's one of the vehicles of prophecy, a dream. Yosef, you read about Yosef's dreams?
Mm-hmm.
Indeed, that was the whole argument between Yosef and his brothers. Yosef maintained that these were not ordinary dreams. Okay? Because the dreams themselves, superficially, it looked like he wanted everybody to bow down to him. It looked like he was an egomaniac. That's how the brothers said these are not prophetic dreams. That's purely your own emotions coming out. But the idea, however, that God can or sometimes chooses to communicate to a person in a dream, that a dream can be a prophecy. Indeed, in this week's Parsha, the Paro's dreams, the seven fat cows, the seven skinny cows. So there's numerous incidents in the Torah where God communicates with a dream. Avimelech got a little message in the middle of the night. The question is being raised, which is a very good question, and that it's a doctrine of Judaism that the prophet is on an extremely exalted level and advanced morally, ethically, intellectually, and in the most perfected state. And the Rambam says clearly that an ordinary person can't just become a prophet. It doesn't work that way. And if so, how do you explain the fact that in this case Avimelech received a prophetic message. Paro did not receive a prophetic message. Paro. Mm-hmm. See, because he wasn't on that level. Apparently Avimelech was not on such, was on a much higher level. This society that Avram was in Gerar, was on a much higher level. It wasn't perfected, but it was on a much higher level. However, there's another point that I have to make. In this week's Parsha, Paro receives a prophetic dream. And that Paro wasn't the righteous person. So you could ask the same question over there, right? Paro, the Paro in this week's Parsha with the seven fat cows, that dream. The answer is that sometimes God will choose someone for the prophetic message, not because he's deserving of it, but for the sake of the tzaddik, the sake of the righteous person. Now, in the case of Paro, I believe, is on a lower level. You'll soon see why. I'll explain to you why I think Paro was on a lower level. Paro was merely a vehicle that God incorporated the dream. He had no idea what the dream meant. Now, it's a fundamental principle that only that when God communicates through metaphors, only the prophet has the code, knows how to interpret the prophecy. Only a prophet knows how to interpret the prophecy. So Paro was not a prophet. He was just a tool. He was an object, and God put the pictures in his mind. So he woke up, but he woke up with this feeling of being disturbed. He had this dream. It wasn't an ordinary dream. Because what do you mean? Every time a person has a dream, you have plenty of dreams, you know. So maybe if it's a powerful dream, maybe it'll last with you in the moment. Usually you forget it very quickly, most of the time, right? How many dreams do you really remember?
The ones that are graphic.
Yeah, okay. And then, but it's not a. If you sit down, and the first thing, if you had a dream and you really want to work on it, you think there's something there, I advise you, as soon as you get up, write it down. Because by lunchtime, you'll have forgotten. You're going to forget very quickly. As the day goes on, you're going to forget more and more. That's a whole other subject, the theory of dreams and how it works. I just don't have the time to deal with that now. In my opinion, in terms of whether a person should aspire to prophecy, there were those who did aspire to prophecy. But the way I understand it, that's not my goal, for example. That's not my goal. My goal is to aspire to understand the Torah as best as I can, and to incorporate the ideas, and to perfect my nature to be in line with the truth, and to be adjust, and so on and so forth. Now, if I should reach that level, nobody knows what level they can reach. No one knows their potential, and the tragedy of life is that few people really, I spoke about this in Phoenix, few people really achieve a significant amount of their potential. That was a topic of one of my speeches. I spoke a lot over the weekend. Isn't that something? Very few people, I'd say the overwhelming majority of people are wasting the talent, the true talent, pursuing the imaginary. That was interesting. We saw that when we talked about relationships, how people are chasing fantasies and ignoring the actualities of life. The same is true with Torah study, that the main reason that people do not achieve their potential, we all have a God-given potential, and God created us for Torah. He shaped you and designed you that if you approach it correctly, the Torah is the ultimate good. That's the best way of life. That's the way you ought to live. The reason, I think, a primary reason, is due to the fact that it's one word. It begins with an L. Human laziness, that's the biggest enemy. Of course, you have a ton of excuses, but there's a tremendous laziness factor. And you can't get yourself to really... It's easy to sit down. You're on an airplane, so now you have a little screen. You're plugged in with something. Whenever you are, you're always hearing music. You're always being entertained. The idea of sitting down and struggling and strenuous and using your mind and really expending tremendous mental energy to pursue an idea, that's not part of the American dream. It's alien. But that's the Torah. That's the idea of Torah, that a person should strive, should struggle, aspire. And that's a prophecy. If you should reach that level, fine. Not everybody is designed to be a prophet, but everybody is designed to be a Talmud Chacham. Now, it's true. The laziness is connected to a lack of motivation. But it means to say that these people may be working very, very hard, but only in areas where there's some very powerful emotional instinct. That's to get rich or to get famous or something like that. It's always got to be. But the desire for truth. See, people will not put that kind of energy, they don't regard that as being significant. That is, again, it's the pursuit of the fantasy, the illusion. like Tiger Woods, the whole thing is an illusion. It's all an illusion of what this perfect person ought to be. You see that David Melech seems to me is on a higher level because God is communicating with him. It's different. If God can communicate to a person with an illness, okay, that's a lower level of communication. That means you're not, maybe you're not worthy of a prophecy. Avimelech, you could see, was on a higher level than Paro. And there's dialogue. In the dream, God is speaking to him. And God, we don't know exactly how it was communicated. The Torah just tells you the results. This was whatever the code, this was the message. And God said, but listen carefully to this dialogue. God said to him, behold, you're going to die because of the woman that you took. For she is a married woman. Then the Torah says, Avimelech had not come near her. Here too, however, God had prevented him. That God also had smitten him with a disease, and that was to prevent him from being with her. So the Torah is telling you that Avimelech had not been with her sexually. And he said, God, oh God, shall you also kill a righteous nation? In other words, I'm a righteous person. What are you going to kill me for? What did I do wrong? Behold, he said to me, she's my sister. And she also said, he's my brother. With pure heart, innocent heart, and clean hands, did I do this? So he's pleading innocence. What are you? You're a just God. What kind of justice is that? I didn't do anything wrong. I asked, what's wrong? What did I do wrong? Okay. That's a very good question. What did he do wrong? If he asked, he inquired, and a person about this woman, is she married? Or she's single? If that's the case, so you'd have to agree with him. Let's continue. And God said to him in the dream, God agrees with him. Yes. I also know that you did it. Listen to this verse, though. He said two things. He said, innocent heart and clean hands. Now, what is God saying? Yes, I do. You're right. I know that you did it with an innocent heart. And I also prevented you from sinning against me. Which means to say that God is saying that I stopped you. That is the disease, which we learn about later on. The disease which you had, which again made it incapable for you to have relations, that came from me. And I did it because I know that you are righteous, so I didn't want you to sin. I saved you from sin. That is the most amazing thing, by the way. When people pray for things, when you pray for things, for Hashem, sometimes you overlook the most important thing. How many people pray that God should save me from doing a sin? That I shouldn't be caught up in a sin. That's not what you pray for. You're praying for whatever. Let me find this thing. Let me get this beautiful thing. Whatever it is. But what about the fact that I shouldn't stumble into sin? That's worthy. That's more important than all the other things. But again, it's the kind of thing that's not on the forefront of our consciousness. Anyways, God's saying, I rewarded you. I took good care of you. I gave you a disease, and that was good for you. Hey, how you doing? But God's saying, I took good care of you. I prevented you from sinning. Why God is saving him is a good question. Is it because of his righteousness? I don't know about that. I would say again, it's to protect the tzaddik. Divine providence is there to protect the tzaddik. The tzaddik over here is Avram and Sarah. To protect them. Whether he was on a level where he merited divine providence, I don't know. It's clear, however, that it's to protect those who fear God, those who are close to God. The closer you get to God, the more you come under the influence of divine providence, the more protected you are. That's the doctrine of the Rambam. But what's the solution? God is admitting that he did nothing wrong, apparently. And I know that you did this with pure heart. That's what God's saying. But not clean hands, the commentators say. You see, he said two things. He said, I did it with pure heart and clean hands. God, what did God say? Yes, I also know that you did it with pure heart. But God did not say, and clean hands. So there was something lacking over here.
So
bear that in mind. Oh, and now return the wife of the man, for he is a prophet. He is a prophet, and he'll pray for you, and you'll live. But if you don't return, know that you will surely die. You and all that belongs to you. Then it says, let's take one. Then it says, Avimelech got up early in the morning. He did not sleep in that day. And he called to all of his servants, right? Imagine getting a dream like that. A little shaky in the morning, right? You'd be shaky. and called. But apparently he wasn't absolutely convinced yet what to do. Maybe he wasn't sure. Maybe because sometimes you have a very powerful dream and you're not sure. Is it just a dream or is it more than that? Is it a prophecy? So he called. He was smart. He called his advisors, and they were smart. See, in the case of Paro, they couldn't help him. His own advisors couldn't help him. They didn't know what to do with that dream. And he called to his servants, and he told them everything that had happened, and they were all afraid. They were all afraid. So they all took this very, very seriously. And then Avimelech calls to Avraham. All right? But let's ask, the question is like this, though. What did he do wrong? And why was he deserving of death? It seems like very, very strange. Because God is coming in the dream, and God is telling him, you know, you're going to die because of this woman. And she's a married woman. So he pleads innocence, and God agrees. I know. But then God says, go to... I understand that part, that if you don't return the woman, then you'll die. Because now that you know, you've got to return her. That part I understand. What part is questionable over here? If we say that he did not sin, so just mistakenly, he winds up with a married woman, doesn't belong to him, he's got to give it back. That you all understand. No question about it. Now, if he refuses to give it back, now you become a sinner. Because now you know that she's a married woman. But shouldn't that be enough? In other words, it should be enough that once I give... If you imagine in that situation, okay, I took something that I didn't know was given to me. It turns out it's a priceless piece of art. It's worth a few million dollars, but I didn't steal it. Whatever it was, somebody gave it as a gift. So now the authorities come to me and they say, you're going to die, you know, you're going to go to jail. Because I said, what are you talking about? That's true, I know you didn't. Okay, so now return it. Okay, so now I got to return it because it's not mine. But why do I have to go to Avram and have him pray for me? Why must he pray for me? Apparently what God is saying over here is that if you just return the woman, that's not going to save you. That's not going to save you. Because the only way that you could be saved is through prayer and through Avram's prayer. That's what's troubling me. That's my problem. What was his sin? What was the sin so that he needed to do tshuva? He had to do tshuva. And that when you sin against your fellow man, I'm sure you all know this. When you sin against your fellow man, you can't just do tshuva before Hashem. And, and have regret and say you'll never do it again. That works for sins between man and God. It doesn't work for sins between man and man. What must you do? First, you have to go to the person that you sinned against and make it up and propitiate. And you have to apologize and you have to solicit there. They have to forgive you. I always say that. Don't sin against your fellow man because the path to tshuva is very hard. It's very, very hard. You know, you have to sort of humiliate or humble yourself, which very few people can do that. And secondly, you're also at the mercy of the other person because even so, a lot of people can't forgive. I know people that once you cross them or whatever it is, they just can't forgive. So from now on, don't do that, all right? Then Avimelech calls for Avraham and he says, what did you do to us? And how did I sin against you that you brought upon me and my kingdom a great sin, a great evil? Actions that are not done, you've done with me. And in other words, he really is, instead of propitiating him, he's giving him an argument, which I can understand. He's like angry at him. So does Avraham answer to this? No. No, he doesn't answer. When a prayer, because he was just venting. His first reaction was anger, and he was just venting. It wasn't a constructive question. So, you know something? You know, it's an important side point. You don't always have to answer a person. When a person... I should have shut off my own phone. However, he proceeds. Then he says, he calmed down. Look at the next question. The next question is an intelligent question. Then he says, what did you see that you did? What? In other words, now... You must have seen something. Why did you do this? Why did you have to make up this story? You must have seen something. This was an intelligent, respectful question. This was a request. See, you answer questions when it's a genuine question. When it's not a genuine question and people are just venting and getting things off there, you don't have to. Answering is not always good. So Avram said, listen to the answer of Avram. He gives a few answers. Interesting also. Avram said, Ki amarti, for I said, Rak ein yiras Elokim b'makom hazeh. But only there is no fear of God in this place. and they'll kill me because of my wife. And then he goes on, he says, and indeed, she's also my sister. In other words, it's not a total lie because they were related. She was his niece, so it's like a sister. Then he says, and it was when God caused me to wander from the house of my father, we made this. In other words, again, he tried to smooth it out. I didn't do this only because of you. We were traveling through difficult places where I didn't know what was going on, so we made a general policy to. So don't feel insulted. Okay, fine.
Is that like when you go out with your friends?
See, he's being diplomatic. He's couching it among other, making a lot of statements over here to ease the situation. But what's the truth? Indeed, what was the sin of Avimelech? And what was Avram communicating? From all these verses, pick out what the most important verse is. And they were very ethical people. They were very moral people. And they weren't the kind of people that would just take someone's wife and so on and so forth. They weren't steeped in licentiousness, in that like Egypt was. But like they were very sophisticated, and they had no fear of God. They overestimated their own sense of rationality, their own ability, the overestimation of the self. But their morality was not rooted in the fear of God. That's what he was telling them.
They are humanists.
I'm sorry. In America today, you have the same phenomenon. Many people have rejected the idea of God, and they're very proud. You know, Americans are very haughty, very proud because we're so advanced. We're the most advanced people that ever live, all around knowledge and technology, and there's always that sense of self. But that is and these people think that they're very, very moral. They have this image of themselves as being good people and just people and right people. But that morality itself, in my opinion, is very, very weak. And that's what Avram was telling him. That the instincts in man are extremely powerful. Here is the problem with humanism. If a morality is based purely upon humanism, it's not based upon any objective truth. There's no objective truth. That's what American society today. You've all gone to colleges, and I'm sure every professor has told you there's no such thing as an objective truth. It's purely subjective. It's what's true for you, what you believe, what you feel is right, that's your morality. You go to a different society, what they feel is right, that's their morality, and there's no way to have an objective truth. So whatever you believe is for you, that's the truth. Subjectivism. See, with humanism, if there's no objective reality, if there's no objective truth, so it's just the way I feel about things. It's just an emotion. I have an emotion, it's not right. If I feel it's not right to do such and such, I won't do it. So generally speaking, a person will recognize that taking somebody else's wife is the wrong thing. I think in America today, for whatever it's worth, I mean, most people will say, yeah, it's wrong. But is that going to stop them from doing it? No. It's impossible. What he was telling him is it is impossible for man to control his instincts purely on the basis of a counter-emotion. Because that's one emotion versus the other emotion. So then it depends which is the stronger emotion. If it's a situation where I'm going to get in trouble or I'm going to get condemned, it's a question of one emotion against the other. But if the emotion, if I have such a strong fatal attraction to this particular person, if that emotion is so overwhelming, then man is too weak. He needs the fear of God. He needs the idea that there's a higher power that he has to answer to, that this will damage him, that there's such a thing as my soul. And in that situation, even then, it's very difficult. You see, I'm not saying all religious people are always righteous. But that's what I was afraid of. I didn't trust you because you did not maintain a society which was based upon the proper foundation. And in that society, with a woman like my wife, I had good reason to be afraid. And that's why he was punished. That's why I believe God punished Avimelech. And told him he has to go to Avraham to learn what... God didn't tell him, by the way, God didn't tell him what the fault was. God did not tell him what it was. He just said, I know you had good intentions. You didn't know that you were taking a married woman. But the flaw is that you overestimate yourself. And you rejected the idea that man can only achieve a moral life if there's a foundation of an awareness of God. A certain awe of the Creator. A certain humbleness of man. That when that's lacking, the egotism, the overestimation of the haughtiness, the hedonism. Look at the society today. That's exactly this whole. What do you think about this whole situation with Tiger Woods? I mean, to me, it's absolutely. What do you expect? Who is disappointed?
Can you even go over what's going on?
It's not just Tiger Woods. Every politician, anyone who has the opportunity. Kennedy, you heard of John Kennedy? He had many. You heard of Bill Clinton? You heard of Spitzer? This guy Sanford. Why are people? Slow down. What do you expect? Does anyone believe that you become Tiger Woods, that you amass this wealth, and it's not just that. This is the American dream. What is the American dream? What do we talk about? What is this culture based upon? What's the ultimate?
It's success.
The success, power, the gratification, right? The gratification of me, the glorification of me, and the gratification of me. Those people, anyone that condemns them, in my opinion, is a complete phony. And people who think that they're better, that they would be any different, it says in Perkevus, do not judge your friend until you've been in his place. The reason why most people do not engage in Tiger Woods, what's the reason why most people do not engage in
they
that?
Don't have the opportunity.
Exactly! They don't have the opportunity. They don't have the opportunity. Now, since you don't have the opportunity, so then you become a tzaddik. Oh, you know, you I'm a righteous person. I would never ever do that. That's not true. You don't know how you would behave. Success and wealth and power, that has an effect upon your psyche. That's a test. Maybe you would be a tzaddik. Maybe you would. But I guarantee you, most people are not engaged. Those who are not engaging in that kind of behavior, it's for two reasons. A is because they just don't have the opportunity. The average guy doesn't have the opportunity. He can't do it. He can't pull it off. Or he's too guilty. He can't do it. It's not because he's righteous. You see? But this society, what do you expect? When people are shocked about this politician, what do you mean? What do you think he became Tiger Woods? Why did he become John Kennedy? For what? To be the great guy that he can deny himself? I wouldn't understand. Well, he'd be a fool to deny himself. That's what he's living his life for. What do you think he's living his life for? Do you think he's becoming Tiger Woods so he should stay home at night and play Scrabble? It just doesn't make any sense. There's nothing in this culture. What is the ideal over here? The ideal is to achieve the ultimate good of this society. It's like the Greek Hellenistic society. That's hedonism. So he has the opportunity. How is he going to pass it up? In favor of what? Why would he pass it up? The only person that would pass it up, that is, I can have any girl I want, or you can have any guy, whatever the situation. You have this lifestyle that you could have any indulgence. And in this, what is he living for? What's the highest ideal? Indulgence. I can have anyone. So we talked about, this is very interesting, because what about this beautiful wife that he's married to? One second. She's married to a beautiful woman. I think most people would agree. I said that wears off. At one time, it wears off. It wears off, and now he's going to see others, and he's definitely, it's like, what about A-Rod? He gets tired of this one. Now he's going to find another one. So you mean I should deny myself? Why should I deny myself? What am I living for? What's my purpose in life? Why should I deny myself? Why are people surprised? Every athlete is involved with this kind of thing. Derek Jeter, okay, he's okay because he's not married. What's the difference? But that's what he's living for. He's living to indulge himself, to gratify, to have all the fun he can possibly have. And no one condemns him because that is the philosophy of this society. That's what man is. That man is basically an animal.
But it's not just the famous people. I mean,
this society, one second, this society does not condemn sexual promiscuity, even in high school. There's nothing wrong. Kids are having multiple days. Well, it has to be safe. That's the only thing. Yeah, safe sex. But the idea that you're having... that you're having sex with many people, there's nothing, no one that keeps that a secret. That's not. There's nothing wrong with that. There is no real sexual morality in this society today. Why? Because there's nothing wrong with it. What's wrong with it?
You know what's funny? Today on the news,
this guy is an athlete.
That's why you don't marry a super wealthy husband, because...
He's got tremendous... Exactly.
Or no famous...
Or you should know the nature... I am saying it's an impossibility. I am saying it's an impossibility to produce a person like that and expect that he will be loyal or why? Why should he do... Why? He's got this... Right now he's attracted to this beautiful girl for whatever reason. His wife, he's tired of her already. Whatever it is. Well, one second. Why should he give it up? Why should he say no? Put yourself in that situation. Well, it could happen to anybody.
There's temptation.
There's temptation. Well, why should you say no?
Because I...
Why should you say? Why should you say no? So he took a vow. So what? Who cares? He doesn't care about a vow. What's more important?
His physical needs.
His gratification. That's what's more important. That's the philosophy. If that's your philosophy, if I'm living by that philosophy, that the ultimate good is for me to have the experiences. Okay. So I took a vow. So what? So I broke the vow. Well, why is that? Why should that bother me? Why should that? Oh, because of guilt. Oh, so if you have guilt, then you're not going to do it. That's the only thing that's going to stop a person that lives according to that philosophy is maybe he's going to feel too. But guilt is not going to be
guilt's
enough.
Not the right thing.
I would be surprised. I would not be able to understand it if Tiger Woods had said no to all these women are throwing themselves, and he said, I wouldn't. They're crazy. Why? Why not? What did you become Tiger Woods for? Don't you get it? It's not to be. You think golfing is winning championships is giving him the high? Been there, done that. Okay. After a while, you get tired of these things. To us, the great Tiger Woods, but big deal to him. So he needs more. He's living a life which doesn't give him the kind of satisfaction and fulfillment. Okay. He's got a big sex drive. Okay, fine. And his wife is not enough. He has the opportunity to do it, and there's nothing wrong. What is wrong with it? What's the society condemning him for? Every form of sexuality in this society is accepted. Gay marriage, this thing, everything is accepted. Multiple partners. No, this is the philosophy, but that's the idea. Who will not do it? If a person is living, who will be loyal to his wife?
Somebody who has God in
them. That's what I'm saying. If you believe in God, that sexuality and sensuality is not the ultimate good. That all this is not.
Hopefully, that
there's a purpose.
That
there's a higher purpose, and that I'm harming myself. That maybe when I indulge sexually, I'm not helping myself. I'm hurting my soul, and the perfection of my soul is the ultimate purpose of my life. Then I'm not going to do it. The fear of God. But if I don't have that, if I don't believe that I'm harming myself, and I just have to the contrary, I believe that this is really good. This is the good life. Then what's going to stop me from doing it? The fact that I made a promise to someone, it's not going to stop me. Of course, if you say you love this woman, well, obviously he doesn't love her enough to just want to be with her the whole time. It's not enough of a love to stop him from loving others or wanting others lusting for others. It doesn't. But in his mind, she's not going to find out about it. Okay, he's not doing it deliberately to hurt her. Obviously, it's very difficult. But according to what you're saying, though, let's assume then. You love your wife. Let's assume you love your wife. Theoretically, okay? Practically speaking, it's very difficult. Theoretically, you can have affairs, and she'll never find out about it. So you didn't hurt her. If she didn't find out about it, what did you do wrong? According to that philosophy. As far as the point that you love her, and therefore you're doing something which would hurt her if she knew about it, I don't accept that point. But this comes up in a marriage. Let's say, for whatever reason, your wife doesn't like the fact that you spend time with a certain friend. So you're not doing anything immoral at all over here. She just doesn't like this guy and wants you to stay away from this guy. But you like this guy and your friends, and it doesn't hurt the marriage in any way, but that's just her thing. So do you think it's right? Would you then feel that I can't talk to even if she doesn't find out about it?
No.
So, because you're not hurting her. In other words, if you're engaging in a behavior, let's be straight about this. If you're engaging in a behavior which, if she were to know about it, would bother her, would hurt her, okay? But if you're doing it in a way, now theoretically, assuming for argument's sake now, that it's possible to do it in an absolutely safe way that she would never find out about it, so she's not going to be hurt from this. Now, your point is very good about the practical, you know, consequences. That's reckless in terms of, luckily, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the fact that she'd be hurt to know that you cheated on her. But she'll never know it. So what did you do wrong? You see, you're right, you're breaking a promise. It's true. You're not doing a nice thing. What I'm trying to tell you is that the contemporary morality is not strong enough to hold up against the power of self-gratification. Because since man is an animal, and gratifying the animal self is the ultimate ideal, so that's going to wash everything else away. And you can't have ideals. Ideals versus self-gratification in a hedonistic society can't stand up. That's exactly his point. If there's no fear of God and you're basing yourself purely on your own sense of the moral and sophistication and so forth, in a crunch, it's gonna lose. It's not a foundation.
He should marry.
Most people that are faithful and so on and so forth, I would say the overwhelming majority of people that do, it's because they don't have the opportunity. They don't have the charisma, whatever. They can't. They can't, or they can't afford it. Or they feel guilty. They're not in the ball game. So then they're
they don't want to be bothered with the aggravation.
Exactly. Well, that's another thing. That's another thing.
If they learn from others.
Yeah. Well, how come they don't learn? How come they don't learn? Look at how stupid. At the end of the day, it's really, really stupid. Because look at what he's. I wonder if he's saying, "Was it worth it?" Now, the morning after, looking back, was it? Wouldn't he have been better off if God had intervened and given him some kind of a disease that he couldn't engage in these behaviors? Because the price is a tremendous price. It's definitely stupidity.
But he can still continue that behavior.
I don't know whether they'll reconcile or not. And this is not about him personally. I have nothing against him personally. He's just a representative of a certain type. There's a gazillion of guys like this out there. I guarantee you. If she should forgive him, whatever he can tell, and they get back together again. If this is I can't understand why she even expects that he's going to be loyal to her in that way. Let's say she does. I guarantee you it won't last. He will not be able to control himself. He can't. It goes against his very essence. This is his very essence. You have to understand that mentality. He's not a person that's living his life on the basis of fear of God. Now, if he would become religious and change his value system, that's something else. It's not him. It's any senator, any governor, any guy that reaches a certain position of power and the women start to throw themselves at him. They have no defense against it whatsoever, except the fear of getting caught. If the fear of getting caught, and even that, you see, Spitzer and so on and so forth. And it should not surprise you at all. It should not surprise you all when it happens, because it's part of the whole essence of what their life is about.
Yeah.